Open Floor is brought to you by FanDuel, the leader in one-week fantasy football, with more winners and more payouts than any other site. Enter promo code OPENFLOOR at FanDuel.com to play a risk-free tournament for up to $10. We're also sponsored by the SeatGeek app, the easiest way to find a great deal, pay for your ticket, and get to your seat. Download the SeatGeek app and enter our code OPENFLOOR for $20 off your first purchase. I'm not saying the Bulls would lose that series, but nobody's killing the Warriors. In NBA history, I don't think there's a team that would kill the Warriors.
I think the Warriors would drive the Bulls crazy. I don't think there's anybody on the Warriors as great as they are defensively. Is Draymond Green, who's their best all-around defender, is he the one taking Michael? Is it Harrison Barnes? Is it Klay Thompson? No one's stopping Michael.
Well, it's a problem, but so isn't stopping Steph Curry. I mean, Kerr, Paxson, whoever you want to throw out there, is not stopping Steph Curry. Ask Steve Kerr now. I think he'd be first one to tell you he's not stopping Steph Curry.
I think you're putting Pippen on him. And with that his combination of athleticism, length, mobility, I mean, I think peak Scottie Pippen would be impossible for just about anyone.
Welcome back. SI.com NBA podcast. Chris Mannix, senior writer, Sports Illustrated here in the SI podcast studio. Pleased to be joined in studio by one of the best video reporters out there, Howard Beck from Bleacher Report.
You do more videos than I do. I don't see how you can keep busting my chops over the video gig when
maybe
you were actually doing...
Maybe it's the hashtag. Maybe it's because every time you do a video, it's on hashtag TeamStream.
You know what? I think you've actually written the word hashtag TeamStream more often than I have on Twitter
I think that's probably true, but I just like to associate yourself with video
You
reporting.
Like things that rhyme.
It's the wave of the future, I guess, man. We all got to be more than what we used to be. Remember back in the day, we were just newspaper writers, magazine writers. We're just, it's a whole new generation of reporting.
True story, on my way over here, I got stopped at the Fulton Street subway stop by a guy who was there for a charity, but who said, Bleacher Report. Like, that was how he flagged me down. He was trying to get me, to donate to somebody anyway, but he recognized me first. It's a very strange, strange thing, because for guys like us, we were always as anonymous as it got. We were a byline, and that was it. So, yeah, it's a strange new world.
Yeah, before putting your face on some of these web columns, it was just you're a byline, and occasionally if someone saw your name on a credential, they might say, oh, yeah, I read your stuff. Now it's, hey, man, love that video. Do you notice that people... Like, I don't know if people are watching these videos. There's so many out there. But do you notice people will say, hey, saw that. So you did something for Bleacher Report.
Way more than I ever got a, hey, loved that story you did in the Times last week. But that's because when I was working at the New York Times, nobody saw my face, you know, unless I did the occasional one-off on, you know, ESPN or something. But now people see between social media, Twitter, our faces, our mugshots are there every day. And if people are following you, they know your face. And the videos, people do. I mean, there's a reason that, you know, your company, my company that I'm working for now, Bleacher Report, that all of these companies are now investing so much on the video side because people eat that stuff up. And yes, I get recognized now in odd places at, you know, airport gates. And when I was in Oklahoma City for the story we talked about last time I was on, and I was doing the Durant piece, and the kid I quoted in that story, this like super fan who loves Durant, this 10-year-old fourth grader, he shouted out to me before I was going to look for a fan. He shouted out to me, like, Howard Beck. Then he had me come over, and he said, he started, like, hitting me with fact or fiction stuff, like we do, like I do with Bucher.
Wow. Like,
so, yeah, people love the video stuff.
Yeah, it's like some will read, some will listen on podcasts such as this, some will watch on videos. It's an interesting way the media world is evolving over the last couple of months. But one thing you told me before we started the story, you are actually going to, you know, use words for, correct?
Typing
and using actual words, maybe multiple syllables. Who knows? If you get a little aggressive out there, you're the Clippers.
Yeah.
And well, tell me what is your take? What is your take going to be on the Clippers when this stuff comes out on Tuesday?
Well, the story that's coming out is how the Clippers became the most hated team in the National Basketball Association. And it's a really weird thing to me because you think about teams in history that people hated, that generated that kind of emotion. It's usually because they were really good and or really obnoxious. And the thing with the Clippers is, by their own assessment and by just facts, they haven't done anything. They haven't won anything. They haven't been out of the second round. But I just kept seeing this over and over where somebody would just, you know, fire off something about the Clippers. And it wasn't just the Warrior thing either. Like, obviously, there's a rivalry there. But then DeMarcus Cousins, like, flat out said it back in October, I hate the Clippers. And I thought, man, this just keeps happening. And so I had kind of had this in the back of my head, like, why does everybody hate the Clippers so much? And there's, you know, some obvious things, but it was just such a funny, weird dynamic, this phenomenon. So I started just polling folks, scouts, coaches, GMs, players, and one coach in particular who's quoted in the story, who says, when I posed the question about who's the most hated, open-ended, but kind of, you know, knowing where it was going, he said they were the most hated by far. It wasn't close.
Now, is that a Donald Sterling thing? I mean, that has to be traced, no?
It's not. So it's not about Donald Sterling. And the delineation here is, this is not about fans hating the Clippers. I'm sure there are plenty of fans who hate them too. This is about NBA people hating the Clippers. This is their peers hating them. And by the way, quick asterisk, a lot of these folks say, I like them off the court. I like Blake Griffin as a guy off the court. We've hung out. He's a good dude. But on the court, Blake Griffin irritates the crap out of people. Chris Paul irritates the crap out of people. Doc, who everyone loves, media, we all love Doc. He's great to talk to, good guy. Other coaches like him. Everybody likes Doc. But on the court, he never stops chirping at the refs. And he has surpassed everyone. I had more than one person bring up the fact that if the baseline or if the standard bearer for referee complaining among coaches in the modern era was Larry Brown, Doc has surpassed Larry Brown.
Wow.
which is some kind of achievement right there. Wow. So it's not about Sterling. And in fact, the conversation I had with J.J. Redick on this, at the moment of the Donald Sterling scandal or that controversy, remember, the Clippers were a very sympathetic team. Here they were. They were banding together. They were kind of bravely coming out and talking to the public about what they were going through, about how awful this was. They were speaking their minds. They were uniting. And they were in this tough playoff series against the Warriors to boot, which they won in a game 7. And so at that moment, I think they had the support of the whole country. Remember, people started talking about them as America's team because they were battling in the playoffs while battling through this controversy and this disgusting owner who had said all these terrible racist things. And so at that moment, they actually were widely embraced. But that, I think, was their high point. Where they are now is a team that is looked at as they complain too much, they flop too much, they are, you know, at one end trying to bait people into calls with the flopping, at the other end complain they're not getting the calls. There's a lot of attitude out there. There's a thought or a sense that they are front runners, that when they're doing their Lob City thing and they're dunking and they're up by 20, they're just going to, you know, sit out there yucking it up, talking a lot of smack, preening a bit. And then if things aren't going well, you're going to see them chirping at each other. So all of these things kind of add together. And you could say that any one of these things you could see in other teams. Yeah, they're not the only team that complains, obviously.
Knicks, Nets, yeah. Even here in New York,
sure.
Teams that are easily hateable, for that matter.
Right, but it's something about the personalities. And Chris Paul and Blake Griffin in particular, and then throw Doc on top of it. And Doc's a likable guy. And again, these guys are not unlikable. It's just the combination of all of these things. Complaining, being viewed as front runners. The flopping aspect of it, which we've heard about Chris Paul for years, Blake Griffin too, although I think he's reined it in a little bit. All of this has just kind of made them vastly unpopular with their peers.
Yeah, I mean, I now that you say it, sure, Chris Paul talks a lot. Blake Griffin, even though he's a physical guy, always viewed kind of as soft and, you know, something of a flopper and a whiner and a complainer. I guess I see that. What do you, you know, watching the Clippers now, though, I mean, so uneven in the first 2 months of the season. Can we just pin it on they can't get that fifth guy to step in there, whether it's Lance Stephenson, Austin Rivers, Paul Pierce, who looks every bit in his late 30s as he does right now? Or are we missing something? Is there more than just not finding that fifth guy to play that role?
That's the other thing about, I think, some of the ill feelings toward them. They seemed like they were going to be something great, and they've just been a perpetual disappointment. And they've gagged, too. I mean, they really gagged. Obviously, last year was one of the colossal choke jobs against the Rockets. And the year before, they were at 2-2 in the second round against the Thunder and lost that one with two games where they were gagging down the stretch. That was all those unforced errors and Chris Paul, you know, throwing the ball away and this kind of stuff. So I think that's part of it, too, is that people just don't respect the fact that, well, for all of your histrionics and all of your high flying, you know, pyrotechnics and your star power, you haven't done anything. Putting your finger on it is tough. I think you do need that third dynamic element. And, you know, DeAndre Jordan, obviously, he's a big dunker and he's a defensive presence. The analytics sometimes say otherwise, but they don't have that one other guy that you can rely on. And yeah, I thought that, you know, Lance Stephenson, for all of his flaws, we saw in Indiana at times a guy who was could really change the complexion of a game.
Looked great. That series against Cleveland. I mean, as goofy as he was with LeBron, he was a game changer in that series.
Yeah. And so many different things he could do. He wasn't going to put up 20, 25 points, but he was going to get you 10 or 12 points and 7 or 8 assists and lock somebody down defensively or piss somebody off and get them out of their game. He could, you know, rebound, bring the ball up the court. He was a good passer. I mean, that was the thing about Lance. Like, for guys, usually the knuckleheads in the league are gunners. And, you know, if anything, he was a guy who I think was more valuable as a playmaker for the Pacers. So now he goes to Charlotte and things don't go well. All right, fine. He still got that package, right? I thought if anywhere, being on a veteran team with a guy like Doc Rivers as coach and a strong staff there,
can play off guys with the Clippers,
exactly,
too. Can just kind of camp out and make shots if he still has that skill.
Be a secondary playmaker, too. Be that defender that he was in Indiana. And for some reason, whatever it is that sometimes just doesn't fire right in Lance Stephenson, which we saw at times in Indiana, too, whatever it was he did have there has not come back. And so, Paul Pierce, look, he wasn't the same guy in Boston as he was in Brooklyn, but he made some really big shots in Brooklyn. He was an important presence on that team. He wasn't the same guy the next year in Washington, but he was a presence on that team. And you could feel what he meant to those guys and the confidence that he imbued in them. And he made big shots. And then in LA, it's just, I mean, this is where the falling off the cliff has apparently started to happen.
Do you think he gets it going, though? I mean, do you think that this is just Paul Pierce kind of pacing himself in some way?
Maybe, but I worry that...
Because I'd still trust Pierce in the fourth quarter if we're in April and May I trust Lance or Austin Rivers or anybody else.
Absolutely.
I got the feeling Doc will, too.
But you and I both heard this, too. When the Nets let him go, part of the reason was that they felt like he really couldn't defend threes anymore. He had become basically a stretch four. And on that team, they've got a traditional 4-5 combination, so if I want Pierce out there for his shot making the last couple of minutes of a fourth quarter in April or May, but who's he defending?
Yeah.
Can they cover for him? I don't know, but I liked their offseason haul. Josh Smith had, I thought, a renaissance season with the Rockets, the 3/4 of a season, whatever it was. And I thought, I thought Pierce still had something there. And I thought Lance was as good a reclamation project as anybody, especially on that team with Doc, and somehow none of these guys have turned out to be the answer. And you wonder, is there another move to be made before the deadline? Do they even have anybody they can move to make a move?
More so, I mean, I think that right now the Rockets would happily take Josh Smith back, and the Clippers might even consider trading him back just because it's not worked out there, and the Rockets have missed him. Let me ask you this question: more surprising in a disappointing way, the Rockets or was seen in New Orleans with the Pelicans?
The Rockets are more disappointing because at least in New Orleans, we know that Tyreke Evans started the season on the shelf and Drew Holiday started the season with a minutes limit that was like at 10 and then went up to 10 and a half or something. He's been going up by increments the whole time.
I don't know if we're ever going to see the same Drew Holiday from Philly ever again.
We may not. We may not. And the fact is, if you think about that team and why we were all so excited about the Pelicans and why we're all so disappointed, it's really all about Anthony Davis. Well, okay, that's great. But when has one guy ever done it all and gotten a team in the playoffs by himself, other than maybe LeBron? Anthony Davis, the drop-off from him to the second-best player, I don't even know who the second-best player is. Is it Tyreke? Is it Eric Gordon? Lately, it's been Ryan Anderson.
I was going to say, Ryan Anderson would probably fit that.
And these are all guys who, by the way, at times have been really, really good players. If you got peak Ryan Anderson, peak Tyreke, peak Eric Gordon, and Philadelphia Drew Holiday, now you've got a team around Anthony Davis. But they haven't had that. They've been, racked with injuries. They haven't had a full roster.
They still shouldn't be this bad defensively. I mean, yeah, the injuries can explain some of it, but being in the last, being almost dead last, second to last in virtually every defensive metric. Yeah. I mean, I don't understand that at all. You've got Anthony Davis, Anthony frickin' Davis, Omer Asik, who should be a pretty good defender playing alongside him for stretches. I mean, this team defensively, Darren Irwin, who I'm a big fan of as an assistant coach.
Yeah.
I don't know what's happening to this team. They don't stop the dribble penetration. They don't look like they're playing hard at all times.
Yeah.
The two teams we mentioned, Houston and New Orleans, if you're going to point their biggest problem outside of any injury issue, it's that they don't play hard every single possession.
Yeah. And in the case of the Rockets, they had already figured out that formula, right? This is largely the same group as last year. They do know how to do it. They know what level they have to be at. They know how the pieces fit together. There's no reason for that big of a drop off. And the Pelicans' case, I mean, granted, they were pretty solid defensive team, but they also went through a coaching change. And that's not to say that, you know, they were better under Monty than Alvin Gentry. And you know, Alvin started off a season, obviously, again, without that entire complement of players back. And that's a huge part of this. And so you get off on the wrong foot. Sometimes it's hard to kind of reconstitute it. But the Rockets are the bigger disappointment to me because they had the more solid core that had been together for a while, that had figured it out, that had become, to everyone's surprise, I think, a great defensive team. When they were complete, the year before, they were completely an offensive identity.
Oh, yeah.
That team.
James Harden wasn't defending a year before.
Right. And that was the team with Chandler Parsons and Jeremy Lin, and they were all about the offense. And they were fun, but they weren't going to get it done in the playoffs ultimately because they didn't have the defense. They lose all the offensive-minded, you know, or not all the offensive-minded, but they lose Chandler Parsons. They lose Jeremy Lin. Suddenly, they remake themselves with Trevor Ariza, and then they bring in Josh Smith, Corey Brewer. And, you know, so they had it. They knew how to play that way and assume a different kind of identity. That they've backslid, I think it's an indictment of their stars more than anybody. I don't think it was an indictment of McHale, although, you know, look, whenever a coach had players are stopped responding, you can say it's his fault, but it's really up to the players. The players decide who to listen to and who not to. If you've decided to tune the guy out, then he probably has to go, but you, the players, have created that.
If I gave you one word to describe Dwight Howard's career to this point, I can tell you mine first. I can say, I would say underachieving.
Yeah.
You know, because he looked like he was overachieving in Orlando, that finals team, not very good. You know, Rashard Lewis, Jameer Nelson, blah, blah, blah. J.J. Redick was there.
Yeah.
Turkoglu, some good players, but certainly not great. And Howard was the focal point of that team. But then it was L.A. and that debacle. Now in Houston, I mean, Houston, as far as they went last year, Dwight Howard wasn't a big part of all that. They won without him during the regular season, and it was the James Harden show for much of the postseason leading into that Golden State series. So I would say underachieving is the closest word I would associate with the Dwight Howard.
Befuddling, I think, might be another one, just because, you know, there was such great potential there. And I think, look, part of this is on us as fans and media, where we looked at Dwight Howard because he was, you know, a big hulking center, granted not at Shaq's size, not Shaq's height. You know, Dwight's really like between 6'9", 6'10". But still, like a physical specimen, just, you know, ripping muscles. And this is, he's in Orlando, and we expect in a post-Shaq era, or they're transitioning because they're overlapping, you're looking for the next Shaq. You're looking for the next great physical big man. And he never had all the moves and footwork that Shaq had. He certainly had the power, and he certainly had incredible athleticism. But his offensive game was never as diverse. But he was a phenomenal pick-and-roll big man, and that was, the bulk of his game in Orlando. And defensively, he was dominant for, you know, however long that stretch you want to say it was. I don't know, 4, 5, 6 years, and, you know, three Defensive Player of the Year awards. And so everything since has been really underwhelming. Part of that is Dwight and just being a guy who, you know, has been kind of childish and indecisive and flimsy as a personality, unreliable. And then he forces his way out of Orlando after getting Stan fired. And then everything that happens in LA, some of that's on him, some of that's on Kobe, some of that could be on D'Antoni, could be on the Lakers as an organization. But, you know, at some point it's you, if things don't work out everywhere you go. And, you know, health got in the way too. But I feel like when we talk about Dwight Howard and we talk about, you know, is he a future Hall of Famer? What is he? I would reluctantly put him in the Hall. Like, he had a stretch there where he was incredibly dominant, especially defensively, for 4, 5, 6 years, whatever, that he was the best center in the NBA.
And he'll probably put up respectable numbers the next five seasons.
But and granted, I think my standards for the Hall of Fame are maybe too strict. But I feel like you have to be dominant for the bulk of your career. I want to see 10 years. You know, most guys, you know, an average career, I don't know what average career length is mathematically, but a guy with a good NBA career makes it, you know, 10, 12 years. The greats might make it 12 to 15 years, but you have to be dominant for the bulk of that time. And peak Dwight only lasted for about half of his career, I feel like. And that's the underwhelming part of it. That's where the disappointment comes in. And yeah, you're right. The Rockets won a ton of games last year and he missed 41 of them. So, He's going to go down unless something changes dramatically in the next, you know, 3, 4, 5 years of his career. He's going to go down as a guy who we're going to say, yeah, he achieved X amount and he got to the finals once and he won some Defensive Player of the Year awards, but we didn't get everything out of him that we hoped to as, you know, NBA fans.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. More with Howard Beck from Bleacher Report when we come back. Modern fans have the entire world at their fingertips. You can watch all the games, follow players directly on social media, and compete for cash with other fans. Now, when you play on FanDuel.com with our code OPENFLOOR, your first tournament is risk-free. That's any contest offered on FanDuel at up to $10. If you win, you keep the money. If you lose, FanDuel will refund your account for more play. FanDuel is the premier destination for daily fantasy sport. You can test your sports knowledge against other fans for cash, and there's no waiting for payment. Winners get paid the same night of their victory. There's no long drafts, and you can pick your team in minutes with the salary cap format. There are thousands of open leagues every day of the 15-16 NBA and NHL season, as well as the rest of the NFL games. There's no season-long commitment, and league entries start at just $1. Think you know fantasy sports? Come prove it at FanDuel. Visit FanDuel.com and click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner, use the code OPENFLOOR, and sign up now. Here's the offer from my listeners. If you enter a league and you don't win, FanDuel will refund your money. That's any contest you want, up to $10. You can sign up on FanDuel.com using my code OPENFLOOR, then make a deposit and choose your league. If you don't win, you'll get that money right back in your FanDuel account for more play. For the NBA, NFL, and NHL, FanDuel.com is where it can finally pay to be a fan. That's FanDuel.com. Try it out today. Welcome back, SI.com NBA podcast. We're joined in studio by Howard Beck from Bleacher Report.
Barkley last week, you know, human starter pistol that he is, you know, on Chicago radio says the 96 Bulls would crush, kill was the word he chose, would kill this current version of the Warriors. For me, it perpetuates two misperceptions, I think, about the Warriors. One is that they don't defend. Yeah. They're constantly compared to these Phoenix Suns teams, and that's ridiculous.
Totally.
Because last year's Warrior team was first in NBA in team defense. This one's in the top 10. It's insane to think that. Second, they're called small. And if you're calling the Warriors small, you're really just calling Draymond Green small. Because at every other position, they're not small. You know, Curry, while being a little light, is not a small point guard. Klay Thompson, prototypical size for a two. Harrison Barnes, he's a three. We saw him last year defending Zach Randolph at times in the postseason. Andrew Bogut, as big and physical as you're going to get as a five-man in the NBA. I'm not saying the Bulls would lose that series, but nobody's killing the Warriors in NBA history. I don't think there's a team that would kill the Warriors.
Yeah, it's tough. And it's funny. When people talk about the Warriors as small, they always forget about Bogut. They pretend that the lineup
Green with, center. Yeah, the one they use for 4 or 5 minutes at a time.
Right. And the Bogut lineup, which they use for the vast majority of the entire regular season and most of the playoffs until the finals. Yes, they made an adjustment in the finals, and all of a sudden Bogut became a non-factor, but that's not who they were for most of the season. It's not how they got there. I'm with you. I mean, this is where eras and rules changes and style of play make these arguments so difficult. Because, you know, if we're bringing the 96 Bulls into this, are we bringing in hand checking rules? And are we bringing in illegal defense rules? You know, the floor spacing, everything that we know about the modern game that has changed in the last 10 years since the elimination of illegal defense rules, since the elimination of hand checking on the perimeter. It's changed the way the game is played. And so I think it's opened the doors to have this new style of play with, you know, the floor spread and 4 3-point shooters or 5 3-point shooters out there at all times. I think the Warriors would drive the Bulls crazy. I don't think there's anybody on the Warriors as great as they are defensively. Is Draymond Green, who's their best all-around defender, is he the one taking Michael? Is it Harrison Barnes? Is it Klay Thompson? No one's stopping Michael.
Well, it's a problem, but so isn't stopping Steph Curry. I mean, Kerr, Paxson, whoever you want to throw out there, is not stopping Steph Curry. Ask Steve Kerr now. I think the first one to tell you he's not stopping Steph Curry.
I think you're putting Pippen on him. And with that his combination of athleticism, length, mobility, I mean, I think peak Scottie Pippen would be impossible for just about anyone. So if ever a team could maybe bottle him up, with the combination of, you know, a long-armed Ron Harper. It just depends on which version of the Bulls we're talking about here, too, of course, from the 90s. But Pippen and Jordan as lockdown defenders were incredible. But when a guy can launch from 30 feet whenever he wants to, I don't know that that's actually defensible by anybody.
And they're going to, I mean, if you take a Steve Kerr off of a Steph Curry, you're going to punish Steve Kerr with a Harrison Barnes or even an Iguodala down in the post. I mean, you're going to take advantage of his lack of defense too. Look, if you put him in a game, I might pick the Bulls, but the idea that they would kill this Warriors team is utterly ridiculous. People talk about Rodman. Rodman was an elite post defender and an elite rebounder. But in that era, didn't have to defend anybody like Draymond Green. Draymond Green is an entity unto himself right now. He's behind the three-point line. He's playing in transition off the dribble. I think Rodman would have a hard time with a Draymond Green because of how versatile he is out there on the floor.
I don't know. I mean, you know, Rodman was pretty light on his feet. I mean,
he was light, but he didn't have to defend those
Rodman,
types of
Rodman did not have to defend a stretch four, really. I mean, probably occasionally. I mean, you probably have to go out there for a Robert Horry or a Matt Bullard or something occasionally, right? Not in today's NBA where somebody playing that position might launch a three on, you know, at any given time. But did he have the ability, the athleticism, the mobility to play on the perimeter against another player of similar size? Like, I'm not putting him out there, obviously, to guard, you know, Curry or Thompson. But could he guard Draymond Green at the three-point? I think he could. You know, Draymond Green going to take Dennis Rodman off the dribble?
Prime Dennis Rodman, probably not. But I think it's a tough matchup. I think the whole thing is just a tough matchup for...
You know what, though? I want to see Dennis Rodman and Draymond Green going at each other anyway, just because of the personalities.
Now that I'm
thinking about it, with all the smack that Draymond Green talks, and as big a provocateur as Rodman is, can you imagine those two? I mean, you know, we saw, you know, Rodman and Karl Malone was pretty fun.
Yeah.
Rodman and Draymond would be fun.
I think what the Bulls could do in that situation is that they could match up pretty well with that small line of the Warriors throughout there, because you could put Rodman at a five when you're playing Draymond Green in a five and match down in that way. I'm forgetting some of the guys in the roster. Kukoc, I'm sure, was there at that time. He could play a light stretch type of four spot. Pippen, Jordan, obviously. I think that the way that the Warriors today are able to just explode leads with that small lineup, which is, the numbers are insane when you look at that small lineup, I don't think they'd have as much success against this Bulls team because of how the Bulls can play with Rodman at five.
Yeah. I did see, and I didn't listen to the podcast. I think it was on Jason McIntyre's podcast or his radio show.
We don't talk about the podcast. there's no podcast in existence but this one.
That being said,
it's a new technology.
The great Sam Smith, I just saw the Twitter link, because all I do is read Twitter these days. I can't read anything more than 140 characters at a time.
That's nice.
But the great Sam Smith was on, I think, with our guy McIntyre saying, no, the Bulls would win that one. I don't know if he said they'd kill him or not, but Sam Smith, who was as great an expert on those Bulls era teams as anyone, he's the expert, gave it to the Bulls. So when in doubt, I'll roll with Sam Smith.
I hear you. All right, one more thing I want to ask you about. Monday, we're recording this, I'm going down to the Garden. I'm going to see Orlando, Scott Skiles, what he's done with that Magic team. I mean, they were such a disaster last year. They were such a mess under Jacques Vaughn at the end. But you looked at that team and you're like, okay, if they get the right coach in there, they're going to be really good. And Scott Skiles seemed like the perfect fit for them, because Scott is like a military dictator. He goes in there, and if you don't play his style, you're not going to play at all. And lo and behold, early part of the season, they're well above 500. They're in the mix for the playoff. I mean, how surprised are you at the impact Scott Skiles had in Orlando?
Not that surprised, but to your point about the dictator thing, I've always been struck by the fact that when you look at Scott Skiles on the sideline, I feel like I'm watching like a 1950s high school football coach. He's just got that, you know, the top button is buttoned really tight in his
snarling.
Neck. Yeah, he's snarling. He looks deadly serious. Like, this is life or death. Like, I could see him in there probably, like, you know, doing all the war terminology, like, you know, boys, you know, you got to get in there, the foxhole together. Like, I could just see there's something about him that just kind of radiates that military football thing. I think he missed his calling as an NFL coach. You knew that Skiles was going to get these guys to play defense. You knew he was going to get better effort. You knew that this was going to be a team that when they went out on the court, they were going to have a reliable effort level and an identity that was, you know, consistent. And he has good tools there. Let's face it. You know, Oladipo is a phenomenal talent.
Oh, good tool.
He should be a perimeter lockdown defender. Elfrid Payton came in with a defensive mindset in the first place and defensive skills and great instincts. So you had a great base there. It was the front court where I think it was a little bit, you know, more iffy, you know, Vucevic and, you know, guys like Channing Frye, who's never exactly been known as a defensive player. But yeah, 15 and 12, I jotted down, is where they stand as we record this. And, you know, I think it's a little bit above expectations. I thought there would be a quick impact because they certainly had the good young talent there. They needed somebody to give them some better structure. And the East, as we know, there's opportunity there. So if you're playing hard every night, You know, people may talk about the East being improved. Sure, it's improved overall, but it's just improved to the point where there's a lot more teams that are kind of hovering around the middle. There's a lot of mediocre, not as much god-awful, but there's not a lot of great. There's no great. There's Cleveland and there's everybody else. So there was the opportunity there. And the question will be, as it always is how long will they be a Scott Skiles team? And when does the breaking point come where it gets to be too much? Because that's been the case in the past. And I'm sure Skiles himself, having gone through this with the Bucks, with the Bulls, with the Suns, you know, I'm sure it's on his mind too, that, you know, maybe you've got to figure out the best balance, because he has worn teams out before. And you get that 1 or 2 year bump, and then it starts to grate on guys. So we'll see.
Could this team maybe, though, be, not, I don't want to say they're an exception, but there could be more of a longer shelf life with this group because they're so young, because he's just getting his hands on a Mario Azonia, who I think is going to be a terrific player once he becomes more of an all-purpose type of guy. These guys, they're barely removed from being teenagers. Yeah. Aaron Gordon, Elfrid Payton, even Oladipo. I mean, they're really, really young. They might still have that college mindset where if Scott's, it's like a Thibodeau kind of thing. If Scott's game plan works, and if we know, that's what the Bulls always went through. We know we can execute Scott's, if we execute Scott's game plan, we're going to be successful. Maybe they are able to stick with him for a little bit longer.
That was a kind of a young team he had in Chicago too, though. You know, he had, you know, young Eddie Curry, young Jamal Crawford, and young, did he have Tyson before he was gone? I mean, he had,
no, that was Tim Floyd, wasn't it?
Yeah. I can't remember when the swap for Elton Brand came, but they, you know,
it's not good.
Yeah. But they, you know, he had a young team there too, though. But I do think in general that premise is correct. I would agree that you've got a young team that you can still mold, that hasn't developed habits and that hasn't developed, you know, they haven't had any success. So they certainly can't say, well, I've always done it this way because that's what worked. Well, nothing's worked for this group. So they're going to be more receptive and, you know, they're going to, I would think, develop their best possible habits under Skiles because they are still learning. You know, I think it's great where they are right now, but let's not forget too that, you know, a year ago, maybe not a year ago at this time, 7 months ago, whatever at this time, 7 months ago at this time would not be this time.
No,
7 months ago, everybody's in love with the Milwaukee Bucks and look at how far they've come and so quickly and what a great job Jason Kidd has done. And that's not to degrade that at all. But they were ultimately a very young team that finished 41-41 in a weak conference. And they've taken a huge step backward this season, variety of reasons. We can't expect too much too soon from the younger teams. This is not this like linear progression where every year you're that much better. You finished 41-41 and the next year you win 45 or 47. The Magic, this is, I feel like, year one of them starting to come up, of starting to figure out who they are and the pieces starting to settle in. But they're probably still a player or two away. And, you know, these guys have to you know, continue on this trajectory. So fun, exciting early on, but still early.
All right, before I let you go, Jimmy Butler pops off the other night in New York about the whole coaching thing. Fred Hoiberg maybe needs to crack the whip a little bit more. This was kind of what some people feared coming into the season, that there would be such a different style from what Tibbs was, the relentless workaholic type, to what Fred Hoiberg was kind of known as at Iowa State, which is more of a laid-back, easygoing kind of coach. I mean, what do you make of Jimmy Butler saying that Fred Hoiberg needs to crack the whip a little more?
It's kind of it's surprising on a couple of levels in that, one, you don't hear this very often. You rarely hear a player say our coach is not coaching us hard enough. And if you do hear
it last year, like we're being coached too hard, like whispers anyway.
Well,
like,
no, certainly. Look, I will tell you this. I mean, you know this as well as I do. There are plenty of people in that locker room, veterans in that locker room, who felt like they'd had enough of Tibbs.
Yeah.
Like it was just, as you know, as great as he is and as much of their success as they probably owed to him, there was a limit to what they could take. And it was too everything all the time. There was no let up. There was no room to breathe. A lot of guys certainly wanted him gone. Now, are they having second thoughts now? I mean, I saw a note, was it in Casey's story that Jimmy Butler is still in touch with Tibbs? That's not necessarily an alarming thing.
It's Casey Johnson. It's probably not true.
No, Casey's our, bang, Casey's our guy.
Right that's, there, Casey, under the bus.
That's not nice. But
it wouldn't be my podcast unless I was taking a shot at a beat writer that I know.
And absolutely. Like. But I, you know, that's, you know, it's at least slightly alarming, right? Because you don't want divided loyalties. You don't want to have any sense that the guys aren't all in with the new coach. And Hoiberg is relatively young as a coach. And you know, it, you know, Butler just turned into a star like yesterday.
Yep.
So for him to be the one calling out the coach, I mean, if I had heard that from, say, Joakim Noah, I would have thought of it a different way. That it came from Butler is interesting. There's some, you know, red flags flying there right now.
There have been some missteps along the way too. The whole how Noah went to the bench thing was a little awkward.
Yes.
You know, with Hoiberg, I guess, trying to protect Noah a little bit, diffuse any controversy and saying Noah came to him. Noah's like, no, I didn't.
Yeah.
I play well with Taj, but I didn't say I'll come off the bench. I mean, that
right.
There have been some screw ups, kind of public screw ups.
And I wondered if that was even a lost in translation thing. Was Hoiberg just kind of, you know, conveying it wrong? I think that was a quote he gave to Zach Lowe that, you know, that Noah had come to him. And in fact, it was Noah said, I play best with Taj. And so ergo, therefore, he asked to go to the bench. Well, no, those are two different things. But you could see where those things bled into each other, right? But yeah, you've got to be, especially, you know, that's a tough media market. That it's certainly a team that is, you know, covered to the nth degree. You have to be careful about the way you frame things and the things that you're saying. And, you know, those early missteps, with as much scrutiny as was already being paid attention because of the way that they blew out Tibbs, and the success that he had, it's making it that much more difficult. But I just think that they have some issues functionally. Like, is this really the right group? Do these players, they have a lot of really good players. Every year I look at that and I think this may be the best top to bottom talent or 1 through 8. And then they just don't seem to always fit together all that well. I mean, they are back to, I looked it up earlier, but you know, they're still up there with top 5 or so defensively.
Yep.
But offense, which is what was...
Can't get it together. Yeah.
And that was what Hoiberg was supposed to fix. And they've got really some great offensive players. Jimmy Butler, Pau Gasol, still at this stage of his career, can fill it up. Shooters like Mirotić. I mean, you know, Rose is up and down. And maybe what this really comes down to, no matter who the coach is that at some point, either Derrick Rose gets it back. He's still only 27. Either he gets it back or he doesn't. And if he doesn't, are they really the same team anymore? Are they, you know, is this a team that just really needs to make a major change at a really important position? You know, it's nice that Butler has stepped into the void and is the star that Rose used to be, but this is a point guard driven league to a large extent right now. And, you know, they may be, you know, suboptimal there for the foreseeable future, unless one of these days it just clicks again and Derrick Rose gets it back. And we see those moments from Rose, but the shooting percentages, you know, whether it's at the rim, mid-range, or wherever, just not what they were. And that speaks to something else. And maybe it speaks to, you know, that the recovery from the ACL a couple of years ago just has never come all the way back.
Yeah, they might have to make a deal. I mean, this might be the last stand of this current Bulls team. The coach is gone, but the players are largely the same, give or take the emergence of a Doug McDermott into the rotation. But Joakim Noah, free agent at the end of the year. Pau Gasol, free agent, likely at the end of the year. I mean, this could be, we could see some real changes within this team in the next, 6 to 8 months.
And remember, this is a front office that has no regard for sentiment. No, like,
no,
they traded Luol Deng, who was immensely popular, with, you know, certainly other players, certainly the fans. They traded him before he really started to, I mean, he was in semi decline, right? But the second they saw he's not going to be the player he was, and we can't afford to pay him the money that he wants, we're moving on. And it was a controversial move at the time, but you know, looking back, it's clear that was the right move to act early. This is a team that is going to act early. So Joakim Noah, should anybody be surprised if he's moved by the trade deadline? As much as he's been the face and the pulse and the heart of that team, I'm not going to be shocked at all if he's moved. Pau Gasol has been a great pickup for them the last season plus, but some other teams, you know, that's in contention might have better use for him. If they see that this group has hit a wall and it's time to kind of reimagine them around a core of, you know, Jimmy Butler and Mirotić and maybe Taj or whoever it's going to be, this would be the time to do it. Unfortunately, the guy that they probably need to move most, Rose, has another year left after this one and at a really high number. You know, he's up, you know, making over $20 million a year. So I don't know if there's a deal out there for Derrick Rose. And so the whatever rebuild they may want to do may not be able to happen fully until he comes off the books.
And you have to look at Cleveland too before the deadline, because unless you're winning like 10 out of 12 or 14 out of 16 going into the trade deadline, you've got to assume that the Cavaliers are, you have to be almost perfect to beat the Cavaliers in the playoffs. You've, I mean, with Kyrie coming back, you've got to be flawless to beat them. So if they don't think they're
in that mix, there's really no sense in holding on to this just to get to the second round or the third round. If you can find the right deal, you got to go out there and take it.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And the thing is, you don't have to worry about falling that far back because, you know, look, Cleveland's already ahead of you and you're not catching them right now. Everybody else, you're a move or two away from overtaking them. I mean, the Bulls right now could potentially finish a solid second, still not make it to the NBA Finals. But if they took any steps backward, it's not going to take that much to come back up and catch Indiana or Miami or Toronto or Atlanta or whoever is in that mix in that tier after Cleveland. Nobody's running away with the second tier or the race for second place in the East. So I think you've got a window here. And, you know, even with regard to Cleveland, there's you know, you have to look ahead and say, you know, LeBron is past 30 now. He's turning, what, did he just turn 31?
Turned 31 on my birthday, December 30th. Me, LeBron, and Tiger Woods.
Wow. Happy birthday, Chris Maddox.
To all of us.
Yes. So 31-year-old LeBron James, still dominant, still an MVP-caliber player, and he's got Kyrie and Love there. But you know what? At some point, we're going to start to see the decline. We thought we were seeing it a year ago. False alarm, as it turns out. But it'll happen sooner than later. He's past 30. That's usually the bellwether age. And if you're the Bulls and you've got a young Jimmy Butler and some other nice young pieces, you have to start to look at that window. You know, we want to start peaking when Cleveland is starting to maybe falter, when LeBron's starting to move into those years.
Bellwether, using that in your story tomorrow?
That is not in my story tomorrow.
Man,
sadly.
I would have been so impressed
I did quote Yoda.
Did you? Please tell me that's a joke.
Among others.
Oh,
I got a little goofy. It's a story about people hating the Clippers. It's a goofy story.
So you have to include Yoda to tap into the old Star Wars phenomena?
I did see it on Sunday. It was awesome.
Did you?
Yes.
You were one of the... Okay. I can't see a movie until it's out for a couple of weeks. I can't sit in a theater.
Except in this case, because we're all on social media, there would have been spoilers. I would have had it ruined. I didn't want it ruined. I wanted to see it fresh.
Darth Vader's already dead. There's your spoiler. He doesn't come back to life.
You don't know that.
You're right.
You haven't
seen
it.
Ask me again in 2 weeks. Howard, appreciate you coming in, my friend. If you could do me a favor, save these opinions from the TeamStream app until 24 to 48 hours.
I will do what I can. And I'll start working on my hashtags for you.
My, appreciate it, man.
Thanks for having me.
It's the holiday season, a fantastic time to spend with your family. And your mom's living room is not the only place that can happen. If you're in the Bay Area, why not take your family to Oracle Arena and watch Steph Curry take on LeBron James? That game is going to be amazing, and you can get the best possible deal with the SeatGeek app. Demand is going to be high for this sold-out game, but my code OPENFLOOR gets you $20 off. Here's how it works. You download the SeatGeek app on your iPhone or Android. Then you search for an event, find the deal for you, enter our code OPENFLOOR, and when you make your purchase, SeatGeek will pay you $20 via check or PayPal. SeatGeek pulls all the ticket buying and selling options from other ticket sites into one place to save you time. SeatGeek also knows the fair market value of every ticket. They use that information to show you the best deals and help you find underpriced seats. Also, if you have tickets you can't use, SeatGeek will help you quickly sell them to another fan. Hate those sneaky fees at the end? SeatGeek has the lowest fees of any ticket site out there and always shows you the full price up front. So, to redeem your promo code and get your $20 check, download the free SeatGeek app today, enter promo code OPENFLOOR in the app. SeatGeek will then send you $20 once you've made your first SeatGeek purchase. For the NBA, NFL, and even the best concerts, try the SeatGeek app, and don't forget to enter our code OPENFLOOR for $20 back. This holiday season, we want to acknowledge the most important person in the SI Podcast Network, you. Thank you for the time you spend with us. We're busy creating even richer listening experiences for the new year, and we'd love to hear what you think. Get in touch with me on Twitter, at ChrisManixSI, and my producer, Alan, is at AlanXKim. Check in on our entire roster at si.com/podcast. And from our family to yours, have a safe and happy holiday.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.